Has your life changed? Are you now in a situation where you need health insurance? Here's some simple advice. Call our health insurance hotline right now. This free service will do all the work for you. Shop the health insurance marketplace and find the plan that best meets your health insurance needs. Don't get lost searching for plans on your own. Let a licensed agent help you for free. According to a report on CNN Money, almost half of those eligible for subsidies are paying less than $3 a day for bronze or silver plans. Remember, under Obamacare, most Americans qualify for health insurance. So get ready to let us do all the work for you and find out the best health insurance plan for your needs. Call this number now.
800-659-7975. 800-659-7975. For your free health insurance quote, call now. 800-659-7975. 800-659-7975.
Welcome to Wagner and Winnick on the Law. For the next hour, Monterey College of Law's Dean Mitchell Winnick and law professor Stephen Wagner will discuss current legal events and public policy issues that are affecting our daily lives. They will not provide individual legal advice. If you have a specific legal problem, you're encouraged to contact a lawyer for legal assistance. If you do not have a lawyer, contact the local bar association or lawyer referral service in your community for recommendations. And now, here's Wagner and Winnick on the Law.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of Wagner and Winnick on the Law. I am San Luis Obispo College of Law professor and trial attorney Stephen Wagner, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, president and dean of Monterey College of Law and San Luis Obispo College of Law, Mitchell Winnick. Mitch, good day to you.
Good day to you, Stephen, and welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. You let me out.
I did tease the audience last week telling you were out being a good dad with your daughter's tennis tournament. So tell us, how did it go?
You did, and you put a little extra pressure on my daughter.
Oh, which was great.
No, but she rose to the occasion. She did win her first round. She beat an opponent that I think she may not have been expected to beat. So that was actually a very good good outcome.
Excellent.
But lots of rain delay, as you know, right? Yes. We were in your old stomping ground of Stockton, right?
Yes.
UOP territory.
Yeah. Well, we love to see the rain, though.
Yeah, and I should also share with you that I did get a chance to thank Patty Andreen personally. I saw her at a function.
Because Patty was our guest co-host last week.
Yes.
We had Jim Lanich to talk about Every Child Succeeds Act.
That's right. And speaking of guest co-hosts, we're also pleased to be joined today by Greg Brandis. Greg is the Executive Director and Dean of Alliant University School of Law and Forensics. And Greg, it's not your first rodeo, so to speak, right?
It's not my first rodeo, and thanks for having me back to the show to talk about this pretty interesting topic.
Absolutely.
Today.
So this interesting topic, I should give you the honors, Mitch, because I think it was your idea to do this one.
Well, it's pretty hard not to look at, when we look at the national news, as we've said we do, during each month to pick what we think the top topics are to discuss, it's pretty hard not to go right to Flint, Michigan.
Yeah.
Because the issue here is just one that it's easy to just outrage you, because here we have what appears to be, and I guess usually you give the disclaimer. Let me throw the disclaimer out here. You know, we don't have any inside information on this. We don't actually know the facts of this case. We know just what everybody else has read in the newspaper and online. So we're just going to talk in terms of the general concept of what happens when what appears to be a government agency, and it could include elected and appointed and hired employees of a state, take acts that appear to have now truly damaged and harmed the population. And the question has to come to everybody's mind: who's responsible? Are they legally liable? And who's going to pay?
And of course, the other issue that's right in the crosshairs here is who knew what and when did they know it, which is always an issue when we're talking about elected officials or those who are ostensibly in the know.
That's right. So our goal today is not really to answer these questions because we don't know the facts, but I think it's a perfect opportunity for us to discuss the relationship with the law in these kind of settings.
That's right. And just to set the stage, I think there's been enough prolific media coverage on this issue, but we're talking about the extreme water contamination and tainted water in Flint, Michigan, which started, I think, through the discovery of lead-based pipes and then ripened into another issue having to do with where exactly the water was drawn from.
That's right. Evidently, and simply put, the water was originally being drawn from the Detroit area out of the lakes up there. There was a determination made that it was a little more expensive than if they shifted drawing the community's water out of the river in Flint, and that decision was made. There's no doubt it was made as a cost savings measure. And one of the interesting points is this is not really a municipal decision, although it's about a city. Since Flint, Michigan is bankrupt, the state had already taken over operation of the municipality. So it was a state decision.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, Mitch, because I'll bring you in on this, Greg, because I think you had shared this when we were preparing. That's a unique factor in this case, the state running the city.
Yeah, it's something that almost never happens, right? Most cities operate as independent municipal corporations. They collect their taxes, they do their business, and all the rest of that. And when they go bankrupt, what happens sometimes is the state government has to step in and run the entity. That adds a layer here because you now have the liability or the responsibility reaching all the way to the state house, potentially.
And then you have the EPA involved. Right, so the EPA is involved, so it goes right past the state house into the federal government.
Now, that's a good point, because when the state steps in, so too do the other entities that are inextricably tied, in essence.
That's exactly right. So you have claims of whether the Environmental Protection Agency took the steps it needed to take. You have the state's environmental department that was involved. And there's really no question that everyone knew something was going on. We now know the result of it, and so now we're at this point where people are starting to ask who's liable and who should pay.
And how do we get to them? And can we get to them?
So this is, as everyone knows, Stephen, as my co-host here, is a former prosecutor, and we tend to put him on the spot when it comes to prosecutorial questions. So let's just put it this way. Stephen, if this were you, if you were the district attorney in the community, and it could be a community anywhere, because these aren't really unique to Michigan law. This is a basic issue of, and you found out that there were a government agency and government employees and elected people in your community that knew information about what we can just call tainted poisoned water and did nothing about it. You're the DA.
Yeah.
What do you do? How do you evaluate that?
Okay, so it's a great question. You got to start from the discovery phase first. So what drew the attention to the problem? Okay, so typically it's going to be some kind of a medical issue or some kind of a medical condition that's identified and connected to tainted water in some way. So the action starts with what was the cause? It's a cause and effect analysis.
Right.
Don't have to be a lawyer, really, to figure that part out. But quickly you move to the whodunit portion, right?
Right.
Because that's
right.
That's really how it works, right?
That's right.
So who's responsible? And as you mentioned in the lead-in, there's a lot of parties involved in the delivery of water in all of our systems. It doesn't just have to be Flint. There's a lot of people that have a hand in that. So who are the decision makers? So the first step from any prosecuting agency is to first determine, is there something that meets the statutory definition of a crime or a civil wrong? Because one thing I should share is prosecutors often proceed on civil statutes also. And it's important to note that. It's not just, for instance, in California penal code sections that drive the analysis. Prosecutors have the business and professions code to work with also in our state. And in other states, there's a wide variety of statutes that could be in play.
Okay, so let's make it simple because we know there's a lot of players here, but let's pick on one. Let's pick on we'll create this fictitious employee at the head of a state agency in charge of testing and monitoring the safety of drinking water. And there's one of those in every jurisdiction.
Because one of the interesting factual questions here is, this is a contaminant that results from the pipes after the water leaves the presence of the folks who are controlling it.
That's
so
great.
So you got to ask, where is he testing? Is he testing at their delivery point to the system, or is he testing people's houses?
Yeah, so
what's he doing?
No, great point. So there's a monitoring feature here that's big. You know, we're probably coming up on our first break pretty soon here. But the monitoring aspect and who's responsible for it is a key component. So we all know as lawyers, from a negligence standpoint, the analysis always starts with duty. Who had the duty? Is there an act or is there an omission to act in this case?
So Greg's great point. So did they do their duty to test, whether it's at the river and or at the tap? Let's assume for the moment they've done both and the results appear to exceed the limits that are allowed by state law.
All right.
So now you have the duty.
Right. So once you've established that there is a duty, then you've got a potential defendant in sights is the way I would look at it, okay? And note that I've used potential defendant, right? Because
right. No
duty, no reason to proceed, typically,
right?
That's the quickest way to get out of the lawsuit from a defendant's perspective. So having established a duty, you next go to, is there a breach of duty? And I'm trying to keep it into the civil realm first, right? In other words, was there a duty? And if so, was that duty breached? And the action always centers, when you evaluate breach, on what happened. What went wrong? And if it comes home to roost to the party responsible for the conduct, in this case, the delivery systems of water, the monitoring, the controlling, the sanitary controlling measures in place, then you've got duty breach.
Okay. And duty breach. And then the question is, well, you know, in this case, after there was the breach, the question was, there a duty, an additional duty to inform? Right?
Yes.
So it went one step forward. It wasn't that they just tested and maybe failed to act. Is there also a further duty to inform?
Let's talk about that, because I think that'll get us into causation and actually what the damage issues were in this case. You're listening to Wagner and Winnick on the Law on the BizTalk Radio Network. Our topic today is Flint, Michigan and the contaminated water. We'll be right back after this break.
Deciding to go to law school brings up questions like, can I afford it? Will I be prepared to take the leap and open my own office when I graduate? I'm Wendy Law Revere, Dean of Admissions at Monterey College of Law. Have you ever dreamed of being a lawyer? We at Monterey College of Law can help make that dream come true with professors who are practicing attorneys and judges. They mentor our graduates. But don't take it from me. Hear what recent graduate Creighton Mandeville says.
I wasn't crippled in debt coming out of Monterey College of Law. I came out of it with no debt. I was able to do some working during that time and some savings, so I exited law school with no debt. I did feel prepared coming out of law school. I started helping friends with the issues that came up for them, and Monterey College of Law has so many great faculties and things that there were resources for me.
There's never been a better time to become a lawyer. Call us today at 582-4000. That's 582-4000. Or visit us online at montereylaw.edu. That's montereylaw.edu. Applying to Monterey College of Law is not hard, and we have a financial plan and class schedule that is tailored to meet your needs. I'm Wendy Law Revere, Dean of Admissions at Monterey College of Law. Have you ever dreamed of being a lawyer? We at Monterey College of Law can help make that dream come true without crippling you with debt on graduation day.
I chose Monterey College of Law because I wanted to continue working during the day. I had children at home, and I wanted to be able to go to school at night where it wouldn't impact what my children needed from me.
There really is not crippling debt that you face afterwards. Monterey College of Law has a payment plan which is manageable, and they work with you. The other huge benefit of Monterey College of Law is that the professors are judges and lawyers. By taking their classes, you really actually start networking. So I was very fortunate because I also ended up with a mentor.
There's never been a better time to become a lawyer. Call us today at 582-4000 or visit us online at montereylaw.edu.
Are you tired of commuting to a job that makes someone else rich, working harder than ever, but getting nowhere? Do you hate spending hundreds of dollars every week on daycare, having someone else raise your children? With our opportunities, you can start earning money as soon as next week. You get to be the boss, work from home, and live a happier life. At Be the Boss Network, you'll find hundreds of work-from-home opportunities that you can literally start today and be earning money as soon as next week. Go to freedom12.com right now and start earning money as soon as next week. You get to be the boss. Get out of the rat race. Work from home. Go to freedom12.com right now and change your life today. That's freedom, the number 12.com. Go to freedom12.com and start earning money as soon as next week. You be the boss. Go to freedom12.com.
This is a national health care alert from the Health Hotline. If you, a family member, or a loved one suffers from knee pain and have Medicare as your primary insurance, we've got great news. You could qualify for a pain-relieving knee brace at little or no cost to you. Get free delivery, and all the paperwork is handled by our accredited suppliers at no charge to you. So if you're on Medicare and have knee pain, don't wait. You may qualify to immediately receive a pain-relieving knee brace at little or no cost. Friendly agents are standing by 24/7 to help you. We also have other pain-relieving braces, too, for your shoulder, ankle, or back. You may be eligible to get these items and more at little or no out-of-pocket cost. Our friendly representatives are standing by now to help you, so please call now.
Call 855-227-0301. That's 855-227-0301. Again, 855-227-0301. That's 855-227-0301.
Biz Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Wagner and Winnick on the Law. You're listening to us on the Biz Talk Radio Network, and you can always reach us by emailing comments at wagnerandwinnick.com.
And Stephen, don't forget that they can listen to us on Biz Talk Radio, biztalkradio.com. I knew I'd get it there.
That's right, biztalkradio.com.
That's exactly
right.
He
speaks the truth. All right, so let's get back on our topic. We're talking about Flint, Michigan. We're talking about the dreadful situation relating to the contaminated water, the tainted water, and we were working through some of these liability issues.
So we're in the hunt for somebody who's liable and might have legal responsibility to pay.
Right, and how do we get there? So we went through duty, we went through breach, and we were just getting into causation, and I think we could pretty much do a drive-by on causation based on what I know. Would you agree, gentlemen?
I would.
Absolutely.
It's pretty clear.
All right. So there's no question that the lead, we know where the lead came from. We know why it came into the water. We know the effect it has on the individuals and the children.
Right. So
no one's arguing
that. As we work through what we would call in the classroom the prima facie elements of a negligence type claim, I think we've got causation. And then damages is also one of the issues. And damages is usually very, very tied to causation. In this case, we've got what? Personal injury, potentially, right?
Well, we have personal injury, and it appears that there's close to $1 billion worth of infrastructure damage now to the pipes that have to be replaced.
All right.
Somewhere around $800 million. And that's just on infrastructure. No one's even begun to put a price tag on the human toll of these medically injured individuals.
So we've got people off work, going to clinics, getting tested. We've got all that kind of stuff going on.
Yeah, that's
a
good point. So those are sometimes those intangible damages that we don't often think about. That's a good point.
And then as you, in a civil liability, if you have children who they allege have permanent damage, that they may have affected their ability to learn for life, permanent, non-reversible damage, how do you put a price on that?
That's a good point. So,
go ahead. From
a damages perspective, it can't be speculative, as we all know. There comes a point when the aggrieved party, the plaintiff, would need to prove damages with specificity. So that's going to be a drum roll. We can hold that one and see what happens. So we went through duty, breach, causation, damages. Let's get to defenses, because I think that is the big ticket item, gentlemen.
Okay, so everybody's pretty excited, I would have sensed, and I know I don't mean light of this, but from a legal standpoint, you're pretty excited. We've identified who did it, we've identified what happened, and we've identified there's damages. And most lawyers would be kind of licking their chops going, I want a piece of this case.
Except this is where the defense lawyer is really getting pretty happy as we go to defenses.
That's right.
Because I have the ace in the hole.
Yeah, and who wants to say it?
Go ahead, Greg.
Who wants to introduce it?
There's this famous concept of sovereign immunity. And that says that you don't get to sue the government for negligence almost every case.
And if we peel back the layers, we're actually talking about the king's crown, correct?
That's right, that's sovereign.
Goes back hundreds of years to the king not being able to be sued. And eventually, though, the king had to agree to some limits on power, and so have the government entities in this country,
That's
too.
A great point. So if we look at it historically, and just to back up, sovereign immunity typically is used as a shield, but I think you'd both agree with me that it's kind of taken on the sword image, hasn't it?
That's right. So in this case, it says that both federal and state governments are not, and their employees, if they're acting on behalf of the government in the proper manner, that they are you're barred from bringing a suit against them unless the government gives permission. So there's two ways the government gives permission. One is in an individual suit, they can actually agree to be the defendant, and they will appear in court and say, "Go ahead, sue us."
Right.
And it rarely happens.
I can tell you that is very rare, and when it happens, it's usually motivated by a need to crystallize issues. The government actually voluntarily comes in and defends. They do so at their own peril, but usually it's done because they want to see issues crystallize. In other words,
right. They want policy. They want it. That's right. Okay. And then the other way is legislatively. So through a Torts Claim Act, and there's one both in Michigan and there's a federal Torts Claim Act, where the legislature has said, by law, we're going to give you permission to sue the government in very limited circumstances. So you'd have to look to those statutes to see, is this one of those circumstances? And Greg, what do you think? I mean, you think this is going to qualify under a Torts Claim Act?
I think you're going to win this one. I think that the defense is going to be able to successfully hold off the folks who want to sue the government actors here. They were acting within the scope of their responsibility. They were performing a governmental function. Well, the real question about that is how much they knew, when they knew it, same story we touched on, and whether that then exceeds the scope of their authority or causes them to appear to have acted unreasonably to such a degree that we can get.
All right, and I want to throw that back to Stephen, because there's two exceptions that usually come up in this, and one is some is gross negligence. If there's gross negligence, the Torts Claim Act allows them to sue, and if there's criminal behavior, now, you tell us. You're the criminal specialist. If it's a crime, is that covered by sovereign immunity?
So Greg's offering that ministerial acts, so-called acts that are done consistently per statute, that are actually well-defined by, let's say, the job description mm-hmm. or the authority that's given by statute. Those acts are very likely not going to result in liability. So the action centers on if and when someone steps outside of those boundaries. And you set it up nicely, Mitch, by referencing gross negligence, because now we're talking about conduct that really exceeds boundaries. So it would be an overt violation of the powers vested in, let's say, one of the elected officials. And I gather we can put a couple elected officials in this case in our sights. Right?
Sounds like it.
Absolutely. And, of course, once again, we're not predicting outcomes, gentlemen, but the fact is the mayor and the governor will be in the hot seat.
They will, as will the department chair of the environmental quality department for the state.
That's right.
So here's an example. One of the allegations is that one or more of these individuals had this information more than a year in advance, and maybe not only didn't meet their duty to inform, but it's possible, or it's alleged, that they made statements that were actually false, had the information in hand, and then made false statements. Now, does that cross this line of A, either being gross negligence or possibly, Stephen, criminal violations?
I would argue yes, if for no other reason just to stir the pot.
Greg, what do you think?
Well, I'm just taking the defense standpoint here. Yeah. I would say the question there is whether their act was knowingly intended to falsify the information that they were providing. So in other words, they may have had access to information, but not known that it was in fact false information. They may not have known that it was untrue.
All right, good. Now I'm going right into the classroom, because you're actually inviting a discussion on mens rea, mental state, right?
Okay? Exactly.
So to borrow the Latin phrase mens rea, what is the mental state? So in order to pierce sovereign immunity, because let's cut to the chase, that would be the goal of the aggrieved party, to pierce through the claim of sovereign immunity, it would need to be established that the elected official did something well outside of those boundaries that are well defined. So that would lead to a focus on, was it a knowingly false statement, which will be established through circumstantial evidence, which will be our next topic when we come back. This
right.
is great. You're listening to Wagner and Winnick on the Law on the Biz Talk Radio Network. Our topic is the Flint, Michigan water contamination scenario. We'll be right back.
If you're struggling to pay or haven't been making your student loan payments, listen carefully to this urgent alert. Have you been out of school for 10 or more years and you're still making your student loan payments? Are your student loans past due or even in default? Can't go back to school because of an old student loan problem? Fast Track Student Loans can get your student loans out of default, stop any wage garnishments, stop collection calls, and stop seizure of your tax refund. Give yourself a break. Stop the stress and get your student loan payments down to as little as $25 a month based on what you can afford to pay. One quick 10-minute call could help you solve your student loan problems. So call right now. Not available in all states. Payments may vary based on income.
800-685-0129. 800-685-0129. 800-685-0129. That's 800-685-0129.
Have you heard about BizTV? BizTV is the home for America's entrepreneurs, small businesses, and those who want to succeed in life. It's the first national television network committed to airing original, high-quality, educational, and inspirational programming about real business people. Small businesses drive America forward, generating 64% of all new jobs in the last decade. With over 30 million small businesses in the U.S., shouldn't you be watching BizTV? With the right kind of ideas, motivation, and education to help fuel the next generation of business owners, BizTV is the network you should be watching. Success stories, new ideas turned into businesses, programs full of sales tips, goal setting, how to manage, how to raise capital, and improving work-life balance. BizTV is for those who want to succeed. Visit BizTV.com and call your satellite or cable service provider to request BizTV.
Due to an upturn in the economy, Main Street Business Loans has pre-approved the release of millions of dollars in small business funding. Your business may already be pre-approved to receive up to $250,000. We've sent out millions of pre-approval letters. We see the economy growing, and our underwriters believe now is the time to invest in your business so you can grow faster and make more money. And we're prepared to give you up to $250,000 to do it. Your funds can be available in 5 days. There are no application fees, no annual fees, just quick access to up to $250,000. If your business did not receive your approval letter to get up to $250,000, call Main Street Business Loans Approval Desk now.
800-430-7570. 800-430-7570. 800-430-7570. That's 800-430-7570.
We paid less for our Craftmatic today than we did 20 years ago.
If you're still searching for the perfect solution to a good night's sleep, call now for prices and free information on today's Craftmatic adjustable beds. And then decide when you see how little they cost. Rated number one by consumers nationwide on ConsumerAffairs.com. Craftmatic beds come in all mattress types, including cool gel memory foam for up to 50% less than today's leading memory foam brand. Enjoy temporary relief of low back pain, poor circulation, nighttime heartburn, mild arthritis. You'll sleep better in a Craftmatic adjustable bed. So if you're still searching for the perfect solution to a good night's sleep, call now for prices and information. And then decide when you see how little they cost. Discover Craftmatic for less, up to 50% less than today's leading memory foam brand.
Call 1-800-316-5271. That's 1-800-316-5271. 1-800-316-5271. Call now.
Are you worried about losing your home to foreclosure? If you've been threatened with foreclosure or receive legal papers from your bank, you have approximately 30 days to respond. If you do not respond, you could lose your home. You have rights. Act now to protect your rights. You can stay in your home. Many times you can even modify your loan. The bottom line is you can get past this, but you must act right now. If you've been served by your bank and you're worried about losing your home to foreclosure, now is the time to fight back and save your home. Time is limited, so call the professionals at National Foreclosure Defense right now.
800-708-7922. 800-708-7922. 800-708-7922. 800-708-7922. That number again is 800-708-7922.
Biz Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Wagner and Winnick on the Law. You're listening to us on the Biz Talk Radio Network, and you can listen to us by going online to biztalkradio.com. We're talking about dirty water, contaminated water, and Flint, Michigan, and we may also be talking about dirty deeds because we have shifted our focus now on who knew what, when did they know it, and what are the theories of liability, and more importantly, how do we get through this sovereign immunity? And just for disclaimer purposes, we're not making any bold predictions about outcomes, but these are all issues that will be front and center.
So you were talking about, as you like to throw around the Latin terms, the mens rea, the mental state.
The mens rea,
of the individual.
Yes. Yep.
How is that going to come into play here? Why does that matter related to sovereign immunity?
Right. So if an elected official or someone in a position to be reporting officially on an incident such as this makes a misleading statement or a statement that may be deemed to be a misrepresentation, the means of proving that needs to be more than, hey, he or she made an accident. You've got to be able to actually prove, and this is done circumstantially, I tried to squeeze that in before the last break, to prove that the person had access to this knowledge and spun it in a different way so as to avoid revealing it is usually
okay.
Where
the it's not just
are.
Intentionally that they did something with the statement. There had to be intention connected to what ultimately was the damage, right? So they needed to know by saying this or by hiding it or by lying about it that it had a high likelihood of causing damages.
That's right. And I mean, I think Greg, you'd agree that the other part of the equation is reliance on some of the statements.
That's right. The damage has to be proximately caused by the action of the defendant. And the action of the defendant here is the misstatement. And so there has to be a causal connection between those two. And that's reliance.
So their statement
keep
that
drinking the water.
The water's safe.
Just keep
right.
drinking the water.
Water's
which,
safe.
Don't worry
it's perfectly
about it.
Okay.
Which
yeah.
actually, I think, is an issue in this case, isn't it?
Well, I think there's allegations that is what they said. They said the water is safe. And I think their argument against that is saying, well, we had one scientific instance where it looked like the levels might be too high, but scientists disagree.
Right.
So that would go exactly to your point, Stephen, that they could point to that and say, yes, I had one report that said it's dangerous, but I had another report that said it's not as dangerous
no,
as
that
I
is
think.
A good
therefore,
point.
I wasn't obligated to do anything more.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Factually, one of the tests, there were 10% of the samples that tested too high, not 90% of the samples that tested too high. So it's easy for somebody to count on that as they make a statement.
Yeah, that's right. And I just wanted to add that, you know, the first trip through the prima facie elements when we were working through the negligence, we did a drive-by or summary review of causation. Causation could come back again because it could be argued in a defense. I didn't really know this.
Right.
Right.
That's
so
right.
That's exactly. So you talked about mental state being an element, but let's not forget that crimes come back into a response. So you say, I am a government agent. I am immune because I was only doing my job, even if I did it really badly, right? So I did it. I made a mistake. I kind of screwed up, but I wasn't intending to poison people, so I'm just a bad government employee, all right? So that's going to be my argument, and then we come back and say, aha, no, your behavior actually breached a crime, right? So how would we get there? I would argue we're going to say that there are criminal elements of environmental crimes and that it's entirely possible that some of this behavior may be shown to have violated state or federal criminal laws. And that, and one of those is, under the Clean Water Act, if a person knowingly makes a false statement, representation, or certification statement in any document filed or required to be maintained under the Clean Water Act, it's a possible crime with 2 years or $10,000 fines. So how about that, guys? I mean, can we get back through sovereign immunity on a violation of a federal environmental crime?
Well, it's pretty clear you can get back through it if you can prove a crime, right? I think there's some question about whether this crime that you mentioned would actually apply here, because we're talking about drinking water. We're not talking about, you know, dumping chemicals in the creek. We're talking about delivering drinking water to people. So if it didn't happen to apply, then it wouldn't be a good defense. But as you say, if you can find a crime that gets you beyond the scope of the employment that we ask our administrative agents to do. So if I'm a government agent acting in my official capacity, we don't expect those folks to commit crimes
right.
of any sort.
And
so
in
that's
fact,
outside
any
the
act
scope, right. and they lose the protection exactly. of immunity.
Right. The other thing that I'd add to that is because your introduction of that statute, and there's a USC statute, Mitch, that I think you were referring to relative to this idea of the Clean Water Act and knowingly, the action centers on knowingly. I just wanted to offer that often there will be a focus by the investigating agency not only on what the elected official knew, but what those in his or her under direction knew. So subordinates that had information that report to a superior might also form the nexus for that component.
So a department head might know. The question is, did a governor know?
That's
in this
right.
case. And that, I'm sure, is going to be part of the dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, stay tuned for that, but I don't think that's too bold a prediction, but that's definitely going to be an issue.
So it sounds like that if you're one of the individuals involved in this, you shouldn't just be certain that you can throw up your hands and say, hey, I've got sovereign immunity, back off. I'm good. I may have made mistakes. I may have done this. Because the other thing that, Stephen, you pointed out that I think you bring back up is everything is related to a point in time. Right, so we now know what happened. We now know what the tests are. We now are getting medical reports on the population and the children. So we know, we knowingly know a lot of things now. But the question would be, did they know at the time of the act?
Not only that, that nexus, the timing issue is important, but also where was the statement made? I'm in your wheelhouse now, Mitch. I'm talking now about the venue. Where did you make the statement? Where did the elected official make the statement? You've watched Senate hearings, right?
Right.
See all the people that are flanked behind the senators?
Yeah.
Who are those people? Well, they're interns,
right?
Usually,
for
right?
the most part.
But
yeah.
they
people,
go by another name.
Staff.
Right. People
they're,
typing on the.
They're fact checkers.
Right.
Yeah. They're
right.
fact checkers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you know the venue is very important because it's going to be an immunity issue, right? Because the
right.
elected official will say, "I was in a tribunal," for instance, prosecutorial immunity or prosecutor's immunity. I make a statement that would otherwise be defamatory or inflammatory.
But you're protected.
In a tribunal, I'm yeah. protected.
But if you lie under oath.
Oh, now you're introducing perjury.
All right. Let's go there because, you know, because let me tell you, I am concerned that by the time you sort through all of this, there's a chance that this wall of sovereign immunity cannot be pierced. So here you have billions. Nobody's even going to argue about it. Billions of dollars of damages that are going to have to be paid. And there's going to be a hue and cry that somebody be held responsible. And if you can't get to them through the wall of sovereign immunity, here's my argument, perjury. You convene a public hearing. You bring each of these individuals who are parties to this in front of it. They raise their hand. They take their oath. And you say, as you said, who knew what when, right?
Yeah. So now the way that you've got that orchestrated, Mitch, I'm almost thinking about entrapment because you're lulling them
the
into the venue.
Star chamber. He's got the star chamber.
Yeah.
A little McCarthyism might yeah, be well, springing to
although,
mind.
Yeah. Although, no, it is important. You know, where the statement's made is really, really important.
Yeah. But there is a case where if there are hearings and tribunals, as you mentioned, that investigate this and you are called in, you will have to answer. If you answer falsely, intentionally answer falsely, you know, there can be felony charges on perjury that could put you in jail for 2 years to 5 years.
So let's get to the topic of aggrieved parties and lawsuits. There's got to be some lawsuits out there. And Greg, I know in preparation you had mentioned that you discovered a couple, right?
Yeah, there's already been a lawsuit filed by one of the folks who's been physically affected by this water. And it's a class action lawsuit, but it brings a different kind of claim, not the sort of basic tort claim we've been talking about mostly so far. This brings a constitutional law claim under the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution as implemented through 42 U.S.C. 1983. That's the civil rights statute that protects all of us. And that clause provides that the state can't deprive a person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So,
okay, now wait. So due process. So how does due process get into this?
Well, Mitch, we talk about due process. We talk about two main elements, that you should have notice that the government is intending to take an action.
Okay.
And you should have an opportunity to
all
be
right.
heard.
Hold that thought, Greg. When we come back, we'll pick up on the topic of due process, because I think it is fascinating how that creeps into this equation. You're listening to Wagner and Winnick on the Law. Our topic today is the Flint, Michigan water situation. We will be right back after this break.
For decades, the students at Monterey College of Law have graduated and gone on to pass the bar and become successful attorneys. However, not everyone goes to Monterey College of Law to become an attorney. I'm Wendy Law Revere, Dean of Admissions at Monterey College of Law. We also offer students our two-year Master of Legal Studies degree, which can enhance their chosen careers, like Monterey College of Law graduate Paul Bieber.
I was working as a deputy coroner for San Mateo County as a death scene investigator, and I wanted a better idea of the legal issues that were involved in forensic investigations. Everything about Monterey College of Law was accommodating to the course of study I was trying to find. I graduated from Monterey College of Law with no outstanding debt. I'm working as an investigator for the San Mateo County Private Defender's Office, performing indigent defense investigations.
For more information, call us today at 582-4000. That's 582-4000. Or visit us online at montereylaw.edu. That's montereylaw.edu. Making a change in career is a serious decision that affects both you and your family. You have many questions that need to be answered before you can make a commitment. I'm Wendy Law Revere, Dean of Admissions at Monterey College of Law. Have you ever dreamed of being a lawyer? We at Monterey College of Law can help make that dream come true. And it's affordable. But don't take it from me. Hear what recent graduate Dan Cullum says.
Before I was entering law school, I was an airline pilot. After I retired, I decided that I would go to law school. Monterey College of Law was the avenue to fulfill that desire. I loved Monterey College of Law. It was small classes. The professors were very helpful, personal. You could talk to them. Tuition is not exorbitant at Monterey College of Law, which is the opposite of the way it is at other places. It's affordable. They have a program at Monterey College of Law that lets you pay as you go, so it's financially possible.
There's never been a better time to become a lawyer. Call us today at 582-4000 or visit us online at montereylaw.edu.
Today, more than ever, Americans need a means to protect their life savings. With a troubled economy and government spending out of control, they've been forced to promote loose money policies, which decreases the value of the dollar and promotes inflation. Birch Gold Group can help you protect your savings by rolling over all or a portion of your IRA or 401k into an IRA backed by physical gold. Take advantage of the best gold prices in years and enjoy the long-term hedge against inflation that gold provides by moving into a gold IRA from Birch Gold Group, the precious metal IRA specialists. Call Birch Gold Group today for a free consultation on how a tax-free rollover to a gold IRA can offer stability, protection, and the peace of mind that your life savings, which you've worked so hard to build, is safe. Call 888-999-1351 and receive Birch Gold's free information kit, which offers the best-kept secrets for safeguarding your savings with gold. Call 888-999-1351. That's 888-999-1351.
This is a
national health care alert from the Health Hotline. If you, a family member, or a loved one suffers from knee pain and have Medicare as your primary insurance, we've got great news. You could qualify for a pain-relieving knee brace at little or no cost to you. Get free delivery, and all the paperwork is handled by our accredited suppliers at no charge to you. So if you're on Medicare and have knee pain, don't wait. You may qualify to immediately receive a pain-relieving knee brace at little or no cost. Friendly agents are standing by 24/7 to help you. We also have other pain-relieving braces, too, for your shoulder, ankle, or back. You may be eligible to get these items and more at little or no out-of-pocket cost. Our friendly representatives are standing by now to help you, so please call now.
Call 855-227-0301. That's 855-227-0301. Again, 855-227-0301. That's 855-227-0301.
This is an important message to all listeners. If you owe more than $10,000 in back taxes to the IRS, the tax pros at OIC Tax want to help you. OIC Tax is dedicated to helping taxpayers just like you with their IRS problems.
I owed a lot of money to the IRS. I was working long hours and weekends just to make ends meet. To make matters worse, the IRS was about to garnish my wages, and I needed to file several years of back tax returns. Then I called the tax professionals at OIC Tax. They stopped the IRS from garnishing my wages. They even placed my account into the IRS's financial hardship program so I don't have to make any payments to the IRS. That's right, no payments to the IRS while I'm in this program.
Call OIC Tax today to see if you qualify for the IRS's financial hardship program. Call 800-790-5988. Call now and mention you heard this radio commercial and receive 10% off their already low fees. 800-790-5988. That number, 800-790-5988. Call now, 800-790-5988.
Biz Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Wagner and Winnick on the Law. If you are just joining us, our topic today has been Flint, Michigan, and of course we're talking about the contaminated water, the tainted water. You're listening to us, or you could be listening to us, on the biztalkradio.com. We are coming to you through the Biz Talk Radio Network, so it's easy to listen to us, biztalkradio.com. All right, gentlemen, before the last break, we were raising the issue, and Greg, I think you had the honors of talking about the class action lawsuit. There is, in fact, one class action lawsuit.
There is, yeah. And we were talking about notice and opportunity to be heard, the two pieces that go into this due process question. And so if the government's going to take your property, for example, to build a highway or something, well, they have to give you notice, they have to have hearings, they have to negotiate with you. That's what we mean by notice and opportunity to be heard. So the allegation here is that the government took our health from us by an active choice to flip that switch that sent that water back through, and they did so without notifying us and giving us an opportunity to complain before they did it.
So in this case, when they first made the decision that they could save money by switching from the Detroit to the Flint source, they could have come to the public and said, look, we can save you money, we would like to do this, and that's the notice. And then they would have created an opportunity for you to say, no, I would rather have spent, I would rather pay more money and continue to get the Detroit water, right?
That's right. And they could have held public hearings, and there would have been a deliberate process, say at the municipal level, like the city council kind of processes, to make that decision.
So generally, there's a lot of administrative and ministerial acts that the government can do where they just don't have to give. Everything doesn't end up being a constitutional issue. But in this case, the argument is that it was a process that took life or property from an individual, and in that case, there had to be due process.
Exactly.
So, and then gravamen there, and the essence there of the claim is the government blocked the public from being heard on the topic.
That's really the question.
That's exactly right.
It's a class action case, so that means there's a lot of people out there who are affected by this, and these plaintiffs assert that they can effectively represent the interests of all of those plaintiffs, those parties who were harmed in prosecuting the case. And these class action cases, when the court certifies a class, they really can be a very big and very expensive process. And they all depend on one thing. They all have to have a common nucleus of operative fact. So what's interesting from a lawyer's perspective is, yeah, they were all drinking the same water.
Yeah.
There's no real difference here. The water was put through the same pipes, at least on the city's end, And if it was already tainted by the time it left the city's control and went into their house, they're pretty well there.
Yeah, I think commonality would be almost an easy check of the box.
Pretty easy check on this one.
Not always the case in class actions.
That's
in fact, there's very often protracted disputes in the certification process.
That's right.
Well, and what's frequently there that doesn't appear to be there in this case is there's all these other intervening factors. Yes, you have an injured group of people. Yes, you think you know what caused it, but it could have been other things in between that made this individual react differently than that individual. And there doesn't seem to be much of that in this.
No, it's a pretty clean one in a lot of ways. And so then, it probably will get certified.
And then the civil rights, there's the 1983 allegation. And I think we've discussed this before within the context of police excessive force cases. It's very commonly one of the allegations there. How did 1983 rear its head in this scenario?
Well, it's a government act, right? And anytime the government acts, if it has the effect of taking away life, liberty, or property, you've got a 1983 claim. So even like the police brutality cases, we're talking about harm to people, that's a government action. Here again, because it was the government delivering the water supply instead of, let's say, some private company that was doing it, it's the government. In fact, the governor is the first name.
So it's another way of establishing the government actor nexus.
Exactly.
Got it.
Yep.
Okay.
So one of the things I guess most people might not have realized in just reading about this in the newspaper is that it's very different that this was a government action versus if this was a private water company. So if a private water company had done this, most of our discussion today wouldn't come into play.
That's right.
You still have to have all the steps you talked about, Stephen, of proving who did it and what they did and the liability and the nexus, the causation.
Right, but you wouldn't need a government tort claim. You wouldn't need to go through that process where the government may or may not acquiesce or protest to the claim.
No sovereign immunity. None of that. So this really is as Greg said at the top of the show, this is somewhat of an unusual situation where you have the government having... The allegation is it was the government that caused the injury. It's the government who is or isn't liable. So if we don't get there on this phase, because it I got to say, when you're all said and done, I'm not convinced there's somebody who's going to end up with a check they need to write as far as a lawsuit. Now, there's going to be more lawsuits, no question. But I think what we've raised are some really serious defenses that are going to be hard to overcome with this sovereign immunity. There may or may not be some of these criminal acts. There may or may not be gross negligence. But it's going to surprise people, I think, over the next year to find out how difficult it's going to be to make this a go in a lawsuit. So where else do they have to go for the money, right? So it's not going to be through a lawsuit. So it's going to have to be legislatively or politically solved. And so we have the state who's already ponied up $28 million. But that comes, it seems like a big number, but it's $1,000 a person. Doesn't seem like much of an effort yet. You have the federal government that's already said they might put up as much as $85 million. And that's, again, a start. But I think what we're waiting to hear is how is $1 billion or $2 billion worth of damages going to be dealt with, and it may just have to be through the political process.
All that money is just going to go for infrastructure.
Yeah.
To fix the problem going forward, replace the lead pipes and all the rest. It doesn't go to compensate the child with the lower IQ born lives the rest of his or her life because of the impact of this lead.
Yeah, well, one not-so-bold prediction that I'll make is that this isn't the last time we're talking about this case.
No, I think that's right.
It will stay on the board for a while, and we'll find a way to weave it back in.
So Greg, what you said is a really good point as we're kind of wrapping this up, is the idea that, number one, there's infrastructure damage, and that's the kind of thing that government's used to paying. So they may not want to put $800 million into new pipes, but government builds roads, bridges, puts in pipes all the time. That's not so unusual. But we're going to see. Medicare might help with the medical costs, but liability, big question mark. So thank you for listening to another week of Wagner and Winnick on the Law. This is a reminder that you can go to wagnerandwinnick.com to hear an archive of this program and to biztalkradio.com to also hear an archive of this program. Until next week, on behalf of Stephen Wagner and myself, please remember, if you don't know the law, know a lawyer.
The opinions you hear on Biz Talk Radio are those of the hosts, callers, and guests, and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, Biz Talk Radio, its management, or advertisers. The information on Biz Talk Radio does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or service. If you have any questions about Biz Talk Radio, contact us at 817-274-1609 or at biztalkradio.com. Biz Talk Radio.